Welcome to the inaugural episode of the Associate and Affiliate Cricket Podcast. I'm Russell Dignan. It is appropriate that our first guest is a representative of cricket's first playing nation, United States journalist for ESPN Cricket Info, Peter Della Penna. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you for having me, Russ.
It's a pleasure. We'll get on to US cricket shortly, but because this is an associate one and I wanted to cover global associate issues when they come up, and one kind of slipped under the radar a little bit this week, the article by Scott Berry in the Telegraph about the next World 2020 stated that we would be moving from, even though it's a 16-team tournament, that it will not actually involve four groups of four, as everyone expected, but is likely to be involve an 8-team pre-qualifier, then two groups of five. And I was curious, what are your thoughts on this?
I think it's a maneuver for the protection of the key full members to make sure that, as has happened in the 50th World Cup, they are not eliminated too soon for the purposes of making sure that the television rights partners get the maximum exposure for a team like India or a team like Australia or England to make sure that they're on television for as many games as possible. It's a fairly cynical opinion, maybe, but I think judging it by the way the ICC has operated in terms of these decisions over the past 6 or 7 years, basically since the 2007 World Cup, when you had Ireland and Bangladesh advance to the Super 8 phase at the expense of Pakistan and India, instead of seeing that as something to be excited about for the progress of cricket and the development of cricket, that maybe we are actually expanding beyond the 8 key full members, or 8 what are traditionally seen as the 8
major teams, I think is the term.
Yeah, major teams are most prominent full members. Instead of seeing this as a sign that, hey, cricket might actually be expanding in the way that people had hoped it would, somebody like Malcolm Speed had been really pushing for it to expand in that regard. Well, they saw it as almost a sign of the apocalypse. Oh, God, India is not in the Super 8s. We had this dream matchup that was supposed to happen between India and Pakistan, and instead it was Ireland and Bangladesh, and, oh, God, this is the end of the world. And instead of having a 16-team World Cup in 2011, let's get it reduced to 14. Instead of having four groups of four, we've got two groups of seven. And people thought the Super 8 phase went on for an interminably long time in 2007. Well, the group stage for the 2011 World Cup was almost as insufferable. And that
and
was
only made
for,
less insufferable by Ireland actually causing an upset, really. I mean, otherwise it would have.
Exactly. You know, arguably the match of the tournament was when Ireland beat England, of course, and they almost beat West Indies, were it not for Shoka da Silva giving a fairly dubious decision to Gary Wilson. That was. I remember people just grousing nonstop. Oh, this group phase is going on forever, and they tried to obviously reduce the World Cup for 2015 to 10 teams, and that got thwarted, rightly so. But those decisions were made for exclusively for television purposes, and I think this is another example that, you know, instead of having a situation where you would have four groups of four, like most other sports traditionally would in this kind of circumstance where you have just a streamlined event, top two teams in each group move on to a quarterfinals, semifinals, and finals. The reason against doing that, if you're one of the 8 major teams, as you call them, is in my mind fairly straightforward, and that's that the fewer matches you have in in that kind of situation, the greater the probability is for underdog to cause an upset, which is obviously what happened in 2007. You know, if Ireland, if a team like Ireland, let's say they have another associate team in their group along with two full members, if they beat that associate team and then they can notch at least one win off the other two matches, if they can finish with two wins from three matches, hey, there's an excellent chance they will be in the top two and will advance to the knockout phase at the expense of one of those major full members. And it's not just Ireland. That scenario could happen. It could be an Afghanistan or Scotland or Canada or whoever else from the associate pool that might qualify, with Namibia or UAE or Nepal or anybody else. And instead of in that scenario happening in other sports, it's a great Cinderella story, and it's a great just human interest story, and great for that country in terms of publicity for the sport and boosting the profile for the sport in that country. For whatever reason, cricket just trembles in its boots. The people at the ICC board table, they cringe when that kind of thing happens.
It's also interesting, I think, particularly on that, because I'm not sure. I mean, my impression of the US, and you can probably confirm this, is that the only time, well, maybe Canada is maybe a better example, because the US hasn't been in any World Cups, but the only time that they get that coverage, and this is true of rugby, I guess, in the US, that is when that team is playing another major team. And in this case, in order to get through from that pre-qualifying tournament that's going to have the eight teams, there's a fair chance that that's not actually going to get a huge amount of coverage, because Australian journalists aren't going to get sent out there to watch this, you know, week of low-profile games before Australia actually turns up. So there's not going to be a lot of coverage of this part of the tournament. It's essentially no difference to what 2020 qualifiers were, at least in some level. And so how is this going to affect the ability of those associate teams to actually get some really needed newspaper coverage if they're not actually even going to get to play Australia or England or one of those teams?
Well, exactly. It's an excellent point. And I do wonder how they will manage to get any coverage. And we've already seen in the World 2020, for example, this past year, that matches that did involve Ireland and Afghanistan, at least from a television commentary standpoint, there was not, it appeared to be anyway, a whole lot of effort put in by the commentary crews covering the event to really do a whole heck of a lot of research and in terms of finding out a whole lot about the players from Afghanistan or Ireland. There was at least in my mind, a notorious incident where Samuel Ashinwari, leg spinner for Afghanistan, came on the bowl, and David Lloyd, who was on air at the time, was wondering, oh, is this guy an off spinner? What does he bowl? Let's see what it looks like with his run up. Oh, gee, that looked like a leggy. You know, he was shocked. And it was clear he'd never even bothered to
look at his cricket
info player profile page, or if there's a tournament info guide, or a player just a crib sheet that it's got some just key tidbits about where each player is born, bats, right, bowls, left, better bats, you know, off spin, leg spin, pace, whatever, what their batting stance is. Yeah, just kind of basic information. It was clear a lot of these guys had never even bothered to go through previous tournament stats. Things like the fact that Hamid Hassan, who's arguably one of the most influential players in associate cricket, and perhaps one of the handful of players that from an associate country that could slot into full member starting 11. The fact that he was out injured was, I don't think, mentioned more than once. I think it took until the second game that Afghanistan played before. I think Harsha Bogle briefly slipped it in that Hamid Hassan was injured. But other than that, I can't remember anybody really discussing it at any great length that this Afghanistan team might be a completely different unit if they have this 145, 150K fast bowler who swings it both ways and is really somebody who has a talismanic presence for Afghanistan. And none of those kind of things that you would, if you're a journalist who covers those teams on a regular basis, you would take for granted that would enter into the discussion during any match, and it was completely absent from the television coverage at the very least. So without that greater all-around presence for media representing these countries at that event, and I think that again will be an obstacle for the sport to grow in these countries. I know, for example, when in the last World Cup, obviously U.S. Soccer, I'm talking about the FIFA World Cup now, the level of exposure and the level of attention that has grown since the 1994 World Cup when USA hosted that event, soccer has grown tremendously in this country in terms of the level of exposure, the level of attention, and the level of interest at the professional level. But just even from 2006 to 2010, it was really dramatic, the amount of interest that was raised. And I think a large part of that had to do with the fact that USA's first match in South Africa was against England. It was on a Saturday morning, and there was, as far as I was concerned, unprecedented coverage dedicated by ESPN and other media outlets to that game. And the other matches in that group phase as well, there was just a groundswell of support. And, I mean, people were scheduling their lunch breaks during the other two matches, which occurred during the week, so they could get down a bar and watch USA play those other two games. And, you know, when Landon Donovan scored the goal, which secured USA's place in the knockout phase, I mean, that was a seminal moment in U.S. soccer history, and it was a moment that just everybody around the country just got behind. And it's not you know, soccer is not as huge as the NFL or the NBA or baseball in this country, but hey, it's the U.S. national team, and whether the U.S. national team is playing tiddlywinks or basketball, or soccer in that case, hey, they're representing the U.S., so it doesn't matter if people know a heck of a lot about soccer in general. They know they're representing the national team. People are going to rally behind it and support it. And, yeah, if the USA were to get that opportunity to participate in a World 2020 or a World Cup, I think people would take a few minutes to get to know a little bit about the team. But if they're not even afforded that opportunity to participate in the actual event and yeah, take on a team like Australia or India the way that the U.S. soccer team played England, or if you go back to 2002 when they played Germany in the quarterfinals, then you know, that opportunity for growth and interest is non-existent.
Yeah, the other thing I actually note about this, and we should move on, but the actual competitiveness of the tournament, one of the interesting things about the last World 2020 is, actually two things about it, that the competitive games, the uncompetitive games that everyone complained about, they made a big deal of it, but the fact is that once you got past the first week, the tournament really took off because you've got these, short groups and short group stages really going. And in large ways, a lot of the uncompetitive was actually the other two full members who really didn't pull their weight at all, but leave that aside.
No, the worst team, hands down, was Zimbabwe. They were an absolute joke. And I think the most distressing thing, if you're somebody who follows associate cricket, in terms of how people were talking about how the first week or so was so boring, and oh, can't believe they let these teams, you know, in, it was such a knee-jerk reaction. And I think people even now have a short memory. I mean, reading Shieldberry's article and his line about how Afghanistan were just destroyed by both England and they were destroyed by India. And I remember reading that. I'm thinking, you know, what match was he watching? Yeah, England. Obviously, that game, Luke Wright, you know, went off and, you know, Afghanistan had a huge shoulder to chase down. And they just came out in the first over and were swinging wildly because I think in their mind that was the only chance to win the game is if they were trying to swing for six every ball. And obviously, it backfired spectacularly. But the India match, you know, they gave India a very good game. And the final margin, I'm not off the top of my head, I can't remember, but I want to say it was something like 22, 25 runs. And, you know, for Shieldberry to come in and write, you know, 3 or 4 months later that, you know, they were beaten comprehensively or whatever the exact term he used, I thought that was kind of an interesting take on that narrative. There was certainly plenty of other games between the full members that were the margin of victory and just the overall competitiveness between the two sides. There was a great disparity, greater than what was on display in the match between Afghanistan and India. And you know, the Ireland match, you know, matches, yeah, Australia beat them with, what, 5 overs to go or 4.5 overs to go, you know, and Shane Watson was the player of the tournament. Australia had hands down the best player in the tournament through the first two phases. And, you know, their other match, they didn't get a chance to defend their total against the West Indies. So that's not exactly a, you know, complete assessment, you know, in terms of what they could have done. So I'm not sure exactly where this sentiment entirely comes from, that they're that bad.
Well, I think it starts, and then they assume it, and then they confirm it by any result that doesn't go the right way. It's like, oh, this is terrible, but if there's a full member result that does the wrong way, it's like, oh, wow, that was a big smashing, imagine that. It's a confirmation bias of their own preconceived opinions. But the other thing is these games that are potentially not as competitive, and we acknowledge that they're not generally as competitive, are now being pushed deeper into the tournament because presumably they're going to go from a 5-team group to a semi-final. So that means that they're potentially playing Bangladesh or Ireland in the last game before the semi-finals when one would have them playing or even 14 groups going to quarter-finals. They're not likely to get past the second stage. So it's even a strange way of constructing the tournament that just makes it less competitive. It's a period when you want it being competitive. No one really remembers that first week.
Absolutely.
Anyway, let's move on to the United States. They had an interesting year on and off the field last year, as probably the USACA always has an interesting year, I think, some level. They began 2012 without a CEO and hadn't had an AGM, and they ended it by fixing those two problems and creating a whole slew of new ones. So has US Cricket Administration improved in the past 12 months?
Depends on your definition of improved. if by the fact that they've hired a CEO on the very last day of 2012, considering the fact that they were without one since November of 2010, so they were, you know, basically they had a vacant CEO position for more than 2 years. You know, you can say, yeah, that's an improvement administratively. They have one more guy working for them than they had, you know, 26 months ago. in terms of the basic structure and the basic things that people take for granted in other countries such as Australia, where you can always count on a domestic schedule being drawn up and matches being played on time, and you don't have to worry about the grass being cut, and you know, you don't have to worry about umpires showing up. You don't have to worry about players threatening to not show up unless they get their stipend increased by $10 or $20 or whatever it is. And just elections being able to go off on time and an AGM happening where people are not prevented from entering by a security guard or an off-duty policeman outside the door. I don't really see how things are progressing administratively in that regard.
And you know, they're disenfranchised. How many leagues they have they got now? Is it 7 or is it 9?
According to the documents that were... have been made public in this Kenwyn Williams legal action against USACA, I believe it is 9 was the last time I saw on the docket. It's either 9 or 12, I can't remember exactly, but yeah, I mean, it's considering the fact that there were 47 leagues just over 8-9 months ago, and now we've got, you know, 20-25% of that total representing the entire country. If your membership is slashed by 75%, that's not good.
No, and obviously there was no regional, or there was like the pseudo regional game played, but that was pretty much the only competition that was organized all year. Is that correct?
Yeah, there's this quote-unquote national championship that was organized at the last minute, more or less, where you had two teams, Eastern and Western Conference, with about 24 players coming in from around the country and coming to Florida for a weekend, and even that was a joke. I mean, they had what they labeled as a 2020 practice game on the Saturday, and then the actual national championship was supposed to be a 50-over match on the Sunday. Well, there were players who represented the Western Conference on Saturday who then played for the Eastern Conference on Sunday, because I guess the organizers down in Florida, who were the administrators with USACA, saw how lopsided the two teams were, and in an effort to even things out, they just kind of shuffled the teams around and just more or less had a trial match. But in terms of the traditional formula in years past, where you had actually a regionally affiliated group of players who played as a traditional team of players, say from California, or a group of players from Texas who have some level of chemistry built up playing with each other, and yeah, it's a traditional pathway in that regard. Like you would have district players coming up through Melbourne to go play for Victoria. I mean, I can't imagine in Australia that would just take group of players from Victoria and a group of players from New South Wales and shuffle them up and say, hey, you're Team A and you're Team B, and that's our Sheffield Shield final. It just doesn't happen like that. You have your state association playing your state association, and that's kind of what used to happen in the U.S. up until this year, where they just kind of, for the sake of making it look like they were actually doing something productive, they just threw a bunch of players together. And that, again, it's an indication of the state of affairs in U.S. cricket when that's called a quote-unquote tournament rather than an actual tournament.
So why is this not actually occurring? Like, presumably they still have someone who is supposed to be doing it. Like, who did it the year before when it occurred? It's the same administration as far as I can tell.
Yes. It's, you know, more or less the same group of people have been in place now since 2008, and Gotsom Dainty, the president, has been in place since 2003. So it's basically the same cast of characters with a few changes here and there. But even the tournaments that were held going back a couple of years, I mean, those were always beset with problems for people who aren't aware. In 2011, they held a national 2020 tournament that was originally scheduled to be held in Dallas, Texas, and through some political maneuverings and disputes, it was shifted from there to New Jersey, and the grounds in Texas, I've never seen them in person, but from all anecdotal evidence, they're some of the nicest grounds, at least in terms of outfields. The ground is are flat, and the grass is well maintained, and you get full value for your shots, whereas the grounds that they used in New Jersey for this tournament were a complete abomination. The grass was 4, 5, 6 inches high, and in some places it was a foot high. There was, I think, one or two instances where they actually lost the ball inside the field of play because the grass was so thick.
There is a rule for that.
You go, yeah, lost ball. After what, 6 runs, is it?
Yeah, you get 6 runs on top of anything you've already run.
Yeah. Surprised they didn't do that. One of the fields they were using, the players really, there was a huge delay before the first match because players didn't want to go out and play on this field because it was just littered with shards of broken glass. There was crack pipes all over the ground. I mean, the ground was in a really shady area, and there was drug paraphernalia everywhere, just littered all over the ground. And there were needles and syringes, and and the players just said, "Hey, we're not playing on this." And the administrator stepped in, and then the politicking took over, and they basically coerced the players into agreeing to playing on the field. But instead of the administrators helping to get the fields in order, it was the players who walked around and with their bare hands were taking plastic bags and picking up all the glass and all the crack pipes and putting it into plastic bags, and it was just a complete farce. Meanwhile, as the players are going around with their bare hands and picking all this, disgusting stuff that was all over the ground and unsanitary stuff and trying to dispose of it, the administrators who were all there arguing beforehand, they're sitting there with their feet up on some park benches, just giving golf applause and, "Oh, well done, players. Thank you for clearing the field so we can watch you play." Again, that kind of sums up the state of affairs and just how things work in U.S. cricket, and it's really a shame.
It is a shame because, they have huge potential. One thing I actually was curious about, and I think it came up, it may have been, I forget where I read it actually, but how is the breakdown in these regional tournaments actually affecting selection for the national side? Because, and particularly disenfranchised leagues, like, presumably those players were playing in those leagues. Are they then disenfranchised, or are they...
So this is a curious thing. I mean, the disenfranchisement, more or less, is chiefly for political purposes. And for those who are not familiar with the USACA voting structure and the organizational structure in that regard, the key element of having a league registered with USACA is when it comes to election time, each league is entitled to one vote. That the voting structure is not determined by the number of members in your association or number of clubs in your league. It's not each club has a vote, or you get a certain number of votes for a certain, you don't get one vote per 50 members or 100 members or one vote for club. It's each league that's registered with USACA gets a vote in the election. So if there's 47 leagues, there were supposed to be 47 votes in the election. And the main purpose for disenfranchising 32 out of those 47 leagues was basically to control the vote, that if the people who are in power said, all right, we're kicking out these 32 leagues, they could do that with the confidence that the 15 leagues that were remaining, they had the majority of those votes. So if they had at least 8 votes that they were confident that they could get from those remaining 15 leagues, well, then they had the election sewn up in their favor. Whereas if they had those other 32 leagues participating, well, then it was a much bigger crapshoot, and there was a very strong chance that some of the other candidates might have toppled the incumbents. So that was the whole reasoning behind that in the grand scheme of things. But in terms of the players, you had many players representing some of these leagues that were disenfranchised who didn't really feel any repercussions. I mean, the election was in April, but you had players, for example, who play in the Southern California Cricket Association, which is one of the biggest leagues in the country, and 3 players from Southern California represented the USA team at World Cricket League Division 4 in Malaysia. So obviously, if the league was disenfranchised, the very least, the appearance was that it didn't really have a drastic effect on the players in the way that you might have initially thought it would, at face value. If the leagues are kicked out, well, then you'd think, oh, well, these players can't represent USACA selected teams, and that didn't turn out to be the case. So there's a sense there that the administration does things for when it suits them. Obviously, if you only have 12 leagues and you can only pick players from those 12 leagues, the player pool available shrinks dramatically. So while the voting capabilities were reduced dramatically, in theory, the player pool open for selection for the national team was not reduced by the same percentage.
Right. Although it does, obviously, it has an effect on their ability to know who they can select if they're not holding any of these tournaments. Unless they're going
Correct.
To the American Cricket Federation.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's some, if instead of having 8 regions like you would have had in previous years, being able to participate in a national tournament, if you've only got 3 recognized regions, then you're trying to formulate a regional team to participate in national tournament structure like you would a Sheffield Shield or County Cricket or Randy Trophy, etc. And obviously, any of those players that are fall outside that those 3 regions would be denied the opportunity. But how do they get around that? By not even holding a proper national tournament this year. So they say, oh, well, we know where the players are. We'll just invite them in. And there you go.
Let's move to the on-field stuff. So 2012, tell me if I've missed a tournament here, but 12th in World T20 qualifiers. But against that, there was a win against Scotland, which I think they're the only team to beat one of the Division One teams, except for, one of the, except for Kenya, who lost a couple of games to win those. Second in WSL 4, which was pretty important because it qualified, kept you in the hunt for qualification World Cup. And then a pretty competitive loss in the Audi Cup, which included a 1-0 draw in the T20 matches against Canada when they were close-ish to full strength, and I think the US is probably further away from that. So it was a reasonably good year on the field, 2012.
Yeah, I mean, you can if you look at the results they've had over the years in the Americas, and you consider where Canada is in the structure and world rankings in the World Cricket League, I mean, it's excellent evidence that the USA is extremely competitive and really should be up there in the top tier, and obviously the fact that they beat Scotland for the second time in a row. You know, they beat Scotland by 6 wickets in the 2010 World 2020 qualifier when USA controversially got the wild card berth. And they, you know, it was a 6-wicket win, but I was there. That game wasn't even close. I mean, they could have won that game by 9 wickets. They lost 3 quick wickets with like 5 runs to go or 6 runs to go to the target, and result made was more flattering for Scotland than it actually deserved to be. I mean, the U.S. was on top of that game from the start, and the only game that they really were not in was against Ireland. Ireland, I think, posted a record score in 2020s for them, and Niall O'Brien and William Porterfield just went off on the U.S., but In the game they played against Afghanistan, even, I mean, they held Afghanistan to, I think, 130 or 132. And basically what helped, you know, they got off to just an absolutely dreadful start. And it was mainly due to the fact that Sachin Adkarni was in his second match back at the international level from a torn Achilles tendon, and he was just completely out of sorts in those couple of games he played in Dubai and Abu Dhabi, and he was at the top of the order, and he just could not get off strike, and he wasn't scoring boundaries either. And I think after the first 6 overs or first 8 overs, USA was like 20 for 1 or something like that, and they just got way behind the 8 ball in terms of chasing the runs in that game. Couldn't up the run rate at all, and then Hamid Hassan came on and just bowled an incredible spell to really ice the game. But you know, the final margin, and even in that game was respectable, and USA had a realistic chance to win that game at one point, and you know, they come back in 2012 and they run Namibia fairly tight, and Namibia went through the group stage undefeated, and they lost to Italy by, I think, 7 or 8 runs, and if a few things had gone their way here or there, caught a couple of breaks, they could have won that game, and, you know, if they hadn't slipped up against Uganda in the first game, you know, a couple of bounces here and there, and USA would have potentially gone through to the knockout phase in 2012, you know, and so you look at their record and you say, oh, they only beat, you know, they finished 12th. Yeah, they beat Scotland, but they finished 12th. Well, I think, you know, you can look at that two ways. Say they finished 12th, so they're very inconsistent, and they got smothered by Ireland, and they lost to Hong Kong in their last game pretty convincingly, but they absolutely annihilated Bermuda, and who, you know, as recently as 2007 was playing in a World Cup, and they beat Oman, who was ahead of them in the World Cricket League 50-over structure. They beat them pretty badly, and you know, the only two games that they're really not competitive in, at any stretch were against Kenya and against Hong Kong. And the key variable in those two games was USA couldn't handle the pace forwards that those two teams had. And you know, one of the main reasons they're able to match up well against Scotland is Scotland doesn't really have an out-and-out fast bowler. You look at Hong Kong, and they've got Irfan Ahmed and they've got Azaz Khan, who both bowl in the 135 to 145 range, and at the associate level, it's, especially in the USA, it's rare to see teams like that with bowlers bowling at that speed. You know, against Ireland, once they saw off the spells of Trent Johnson and Boyd Rankin, they scored fairly comfortably. The batsmen looked somewhat comfortable in those games. You know, Scotland doesn't have a bowler like that, so they're able to compete. Canada doesn't have a bowler of that caliber, pace bowling wise. So USA is able to be competitive against Canada in that regard. And so in the associate structure, USA has the batsmen to compete, and they have good enough spin bowlers to compete. And, you know, they do match up well against certain teams, so when they do come up against Scotland or Canada and teams like that, they're certainly in the game from the start. It's just a matter of you know, building confidence against pace bowling, which obviously so many associate teams struggle with, because it's very rare to come up against somebody who's bowling at 140. Other than that, I think USA has shown themselves to be able to compete with a lot of the associate teams.
In some ways, too, I guess that's because, and this might also apply to Nepal, because you're at that lower division where you never ever see those bowlers except that this, you know, once every 3 years or whatever you get the World 320. Then it's a big step up, whereas Canada and Scotland get to see Boyd Rankin and Hamid Hassan every couple of months. So they're at least able to have this sense of, we've got a plan to tackle this. But so I guess that means from the US point of view that the most important thing is that they need to get up that extra division so they can actually face these bowlers slightly more regularly.
No, I mean, absolutely. And so if they can finish in the top two in Division Three and have a respectful showing at the World Cup qualifier next year in New Zealand, if they can finagle their way into the Intercontinental Cup, you know, and get that first class experience, and have those 4 day fixtures where they can have extended periods of time, hopefully facing some top flight, you know, bowling on a consistent basis, that would help them tremendously. I mean, I know, excuse me, from speaking with some of the players who were part of the Under-19 World Cup team in 2010. I mean, the first match that USA played in New Zealand in that Under-19 World Cup was against Australia, and Australia had a bowling attack with Alistair McDermott and Josh Hazlewood, and those kids had never faced pace like that in their lives, and they were, I believe, 27 for 7 at one point, but you had one player, Andy Muhammad, who went on to score 70 against Australia, and he got out stumped in the end to Adam Zampa, who's been bowling in the Big Bash League with some regularity. But you know, they've come up against players like that at age group level, and you talk to the kids, and they said, you know, hey, the first 2 or 3 overs I was facing that bowling, I was, you know, fearing for my life. But, you know, after I got settled in, hey, you know, it wasn't that bad. And I really relished the challenge. And if I could have faced Bolin like that in 10 more matches, my development would have progressed immeasurably. But the problem is, I faced Josh Hazlewood once, I faced Alistair McDermott once, and I haven't faced Bolin like that in 2 years since then. And you know, that's the problem. I mean, if they're not exposed to it and they don't get the opportunity to develop against that and get opportunities to test themselves against that skill level, of course they're never going to improve, and of course they're never going to go. You can only improve by facing somebody who's better than you and testing yourself against somebody who's better than you. If you're a senior player and you're trying to get better by facing 15-year-olds and 16-year-olds in the Nets, you know, what the hell is the point of that? If you're the only way you're going to improve is by facing somebody who's a step above you, and if they only get that opportunity once every 2 years or once every 3 years, it's very difficult to see any team improve in that regard.
Something comes to mind with that as well, which is, and this is not just a U.S. problem, that the American region has really struggled in WCL tournaments of the past, you know, 4 or 5. Like, Bermuda's been relegated, I think, 2 or 3 times. They're now down to, they're in 3, I think. Argentina's lost some ridiculous number of games in a row. I think it's 14 or 15. Canada's actually struggling quite a lot at the moment, and we can probably get onto them later. But to what extent is the US also having an issue that they're in a region where their only test nation is the West Indies, and the West Indies are impoverished and not great, whereas Ireland can send their kids to county cricket, and Scotland can send their kids to county cricket, and PNG's playing in regional tournaments in Australia all the time. And how big an issue is this for the US, that they're only tests kind of within their regional area, and for the other place as well, is the West Indies?
Well, I'm not sure what has happened in the last couple of years that those kind of opportunities have dried up. If West Indies is trying to develop their own revenue structures in a different way, but now throughout the 90s and the 2000s, there were some instances where, you know, periodically, I don't know if it was every year, but maybe every 2 years or every 3 years, the USA would be invited to participate in the Red Stripe 50-over tournament, Red Stripe Bowl, or the Shell Shield, or 50-over, whatever was the 50-over domestic tournament in the West Indies.
You probably kept getting a sponsor change.
Yeah. The USA participated in it many times. You know, and as recently as 2008, the West Indies Cricket Board Cup, the USA went down there and participated in that just ahead of playing in the ICC Americas tournament. And so you had players, I remember seeing one scorecard that you know, the Barbados team at the time, I think it had either 3 or 4 test level bowlers. You know, you would have had Tino Best and I want to say Corey Collymore, and you know, they might have faced in some of the other matches if it was Suleiman Banner. In terms of the batsmen, you know, Bolin to the, you know, Wavell Hines, or you know, Dwayne Smith, or you know, Gale, or you know, whoever. You know, there were U.S. teams were able to test themselves against the West Indies Island teams, and that you know, again, that was not just a one off in 2008. That if you go through do a search on Cricket Archive or on Cricket Info, you could find over the years that they were invited to participate in those events. And I don't know if it was something that they were afforded those opportunities because throughout the 90s and the 2000s, hey, USA was always participating in the World Cup qualifiers, so they were always seen to be at one of the upper echelon associate nations, and so it was not going to take away from the tournament if USA participated, whereas now, you know, after 2008, USA was in Division 5, and they've had to kind of progress their way back up there to kind of get back into what's considered the top flight of the associate and affiliate teams, and so, you know, it'll look bad for the West Indies if they're inviting the USA, who's in Division 5 or Division 4, and they're ignoring Bermuda or Canada or some teams that are ranked above the USA to invite them to the same tournament. I'm not sure what exactly is going on there, but yeah, USA used to have those opportunities. Haven't really gotten in recent years. We have seen Canada and the Netherlands a couple years ago get invited to participate in the West Indies domestic 2020 tournament, but now that they're shifting their strategy to kind of have a franchise-based tournament and it's similar to the Big Bash, those opportunities don't appear to be on the table anymore. So that's obviously not a good sign for associate cricket. But, I mean, I those opportunities that USA did have in the past, you know, they certainly didn't make the most of them. And I know for example, the 2008 event, they didn't have their best players available. And I think that's something that Ireland and or Scotland has an issue with in the county cricket 40-over competition, that so many of their players are contracted to the counties. So when Ireland participates in those events or Scotland participates in this 40-over competition, it's not like Paul Sterling or Ed Joyce is playing for Ireland in those matches. They're playing for Middlesex. And you know, some of the other players are snapped up by the counties. And the only time they're playing for Ireland or Scotland is in the true international matches. And USA kind of faced the same problem. The team that played in the 2008 ICC Americas tournament and won that was a full-strength USA side. The team that played in the West Indies Cricket Board Cup 2 weeks earlier was might have had two or three or four players from the full-strength USA side. So that's one of the issues that, you know, associate teams face, because players aren't professionalized. And if they can't get enough time off work for all these matches, they have to be sensible about which ones to take off on, which ones they can. And the ones that get bigger emphasis are obviously the ones that have to do with some sort of ICC World Cup qualification or ICC event qualification.
The other way of gaining that sort of experience is to actually go away. I know the PNG's done quite well getting players to play in the Australian club competitions. Are those types of opportunities available to the US cricket?
There's more eagerness, I think, for kind of younger players, youngish players, to go play club cricket or league cricket in England from the US. I know there's a handful of players who have gone and played a season or have had some experiences playing club cricket in England.
It'd be much better over here, though, surely, because surely your season is the same as this.
It is goofy, but, I mean, I hear a lot of guys talk about this. I don't understand why. I don't know if it's just a psychological thing or if it's a family thing or what, but, yeah, in theory, you would think, oh, you know, play in the U.S. in the northern summer and then go try and play in Australia, New Zealand, South Africa in the southern summer, but for most of the guys I've talked to are, you know, said, hey, why don't you, have you ever thought about doing this, or have you ever had any interest in doing this? And the typical response I've always gotten is, oh, no, I can never do that. It'd be too far away from my family. You know, the plane flight is too long.
Really? Oh, man.
That's the response they always give. I mean, I would, if I was in that position, I would jump at the opportunity to go do it. But for the players, I've always asked for this off. That's 14 hours away. And, oh, I can never do that. Whereas I would think that now more than ever, it's more convenient. I mean, the plane travel is a hell of a lot better than it was for anybody who might have wanted to do this 20, 30 years ago. So I don't know. But players I've mentioned it to have always been pretty ambivalent. I mean, because when that partnership was announced back in 2010 with New Zealand Cricket, 2009, and or in 2009, the initial bits of it were kind of formulated, and they had this player camp in Florida where they invited Deepak Patel to come in and coach some of the U.S. players at some specialist camp, and he was kind of a consultant for the under 19 team when they went to New Zealand for the World Cup, and then when USA went to Dubai and Nepal for the qualifier, and then for Division 5, Deepak was with the team the whole time there. There was all this talk at the time of, you know, Deepak has an academy in Auckland, and you know, he basically said to a lot of the players, "Hey, I've got an open door, so for anybody who wants to come and train at my academy, I'd be happy to have you, and I'd coordinate and set you up, make sure you get a spot in a local club team so you could be able to play club cricket in Auckland for 3 or 4 months, whatever." And this seems like an incredible opportunity, and nobody took him up on the offer.
That's amazing. USA is not that poor. I mean, they seem to get reasonable funding. You think you could just, like, here's 10 scholarships, go. That'd be their best.
You know, yeah, so, you know, and that was one of the key things that, you know, when they first had this partnership with New Zealand Cricket, it's, hey, we're going to try and facilitate players to go play club cricket, play district cricket in New Zealand to help improve their skills and get them some good experience on a consistent basis, especially, you know, if they can do it in the southern summer. And, you know, since the whole initiative started, got in the works in 2009, nobody's taken them up on that. And, I always ask guys why, you know, Deepak made this offer. I think, you know, USAC is supposed to have this relationship with New Zealand Cricket. Why isn't anybody trying, you know, tap into that?
Looking at Canada, how are you assessing their performance? I gather you saw a little bit of the Audi Cup because you would have been in England, but...
I watched every ball.
Are they slipping badly? Are they in danger of dropping out of the Division 1? Or was it the US actually played reasonably well? And because I get the sense that Canada, I mean, they have been struggling in their WCL matches, I think, their ICAP matches particularly. So they're rebuilding. Obviously, their top three, I think, is an average age of about 19 or 20 now. Are they, from what you've seen of them, are they going to be able to stay above, say, Nepal? Or,
I mean, it's going to be a huge challenge. If I mean, seeing them in the you know, the World 2020 qualifier in March, and going back, you know, for whatever people saw them in the World Cup in 2011, and you know, the Audi Cup and some of the other fixtures, yeah, that they played recently. I mean, that they are struggling. You had a huge personality like John Davison, who, you know, retire, and he was not the player he was over the last few years. That he wasn't, you know, that he displayed in 2003 and then 2007, and that whole stretch in between.
There was Bagai as well, who was the other really class player, I think.
Ashish Bagai, yeah. You know, you had two players who were staples for them for a long time, who they haven't been able to develop like-for-like replacements for, which has been a huge problem. And when he was around, when you had John Davidson there, you could, there was always a chance, hey, they could pull off a stunning upset if you have somebody who, at least at the associate level, is a match winner. It wasn't just with the bat. You know, people remember the century he scored in the World Cup, but associate aficionados might know that, you know, in 2005, in the Intercontinental Cup, first year of the Intercontinental Cup against the USA, I believe he took 17 wickets in a match, it's bowling off spin. He just had these remarkable figures, and I want to say it was, forget what reading what it was the report, but I want to say it was, you know, one of the best first class figures since Jim Laker, or something absurd like that. I mean, it was an incredible performance, and so he had tremendous value to Canada in two ways, and as an all rounder, and you have Bagai, who was their most established batsman and one of their few contracted players, that he was a full-time professional. And both of them have gone on to different things and walked away. And, you know, you don't have players of that caliber in the team anymore. And, you know, you can commend Canada for trying to develop, showing a commitment to youth. I mean, they've had Nitish Kumar and Urban Nagunasekera and Hiro Patel, who were all part of the group of players for their 2010 under 19 World Cup team, and there's a couple other ones in there too that they've shown a commitment to developing, giving them as many opportunities as possible through especially the Intercontinental Cup. But after a certain point, they're going to have to really start performing, and those performances haven't, that I think people have been looking for them, haven't been as consistent as they need to be. And you know, on the bowling side, again, having match-winning bowlers is what will set you apart at any level. And if you look at the associate teams, the most successful teams are the ones that have the best bowling attacks. I mean, Canada and Afghanistan, Their bowling units are head and shoulders above the bowling units of most of the other teams, and one of the reasons why Nepal is so competitive is their bowling unit. I mean, their batting is nowhere close to the level of some of the other teams that are above them, but the reason why they're able to compete and give other teams a scare and give them a fight is because the spin bowlers are phenomenal. And Canada doesn't really have the world-class threatening bowler who's going to win you a match at the moment. And, Kenya, the two teams out of the top six that are most under threat of retaining their status as ODN nations and being part of the Intercontinental Cup and staying in that top flight structure and also getting the high-performance program funding are Canada and Kenya, and a large reason why is they just don't have any or enough genuine match-winning players. I think when Hiro Patel scored at 50 against Australia in the World Cup, people were excited for him and hoping, hey, maybe they've got somebody who can, they've got a genuine prospect for the future. But Canada hasn't been on a global stage since the 2011 World Cup to see really if Hiro Patel can repeat that kind of performance against Sean Tate and Brett Lee type of attack. And, you know, if they're not developing other players around him, it's going to be hard for Canada to stay up in that structure. And, yeah, you could see somebody like Namibia or Nepal come up and take their place.
So I think I'm more or less out of stuff to talk about. I did want to ask you, and I'm not sure what your level of knowledge of this is, but the first tournament in the Americas region is the qualifiers for Division Two in the Bahamas in February the 4th. Last time it was pretty close. Suriname won, but like they were one game ahead of Panama and Belize and Turks and Caicos, and they then didn't get relegated, which Argentina continued their remarkable relegation record. So do you know much about these sides? Who do you think is going to come up? Will Argentina be able to come back up, or you obviously seen them most recently?
Argentina, that's a good question. I mean, they're a side with a lot of energy in the field, but their batting and their bowling don't really measure up. I mean, they have enough players still left who have enough experience playing in you know, World Cricket League events, and they at least have had the experience of playing against the USAs and Canadas on a semi-regular basis. But, you know, I haven't seen enough of the other teams to really know what they offer in terms of competition to maybe get promoted back into Division One ahead of Argentina. But Argentina has struggled for a very long time, and their struggles basically can be traced to the player pool available. If you look at the ICC data, I think they only have something like 400 or 500 players in the entire country who are registered and playing league or club cricket in Argentina, and it's almost remarkable the fact that they were up in Division 3 or Division 2 as recently as 2007 and 2008.
Yeah, how did they get there? Did they just get put there and then they've just been slowly dropping, or...
They took USA's spot in Division 3 back in 2007. So when USA was under suspension, World Cricket League Division 3, that was in Darwin, USA was supposed to be in there as a result of being one of the bottom two finishers in the 2005 World Cup qualifier. And when they were suspended, there, I guess they nominated a team from the Americas to take their place, and so that team was Argentina, and they finished second, I think, in that tournament.
And it was at home, I think.
They finished second in Division 3, and then they got promoted up to Division 2, and then Division. I don't know where, I forget where Division 2 was, if that was in Argentina or if the next Division 3 was in Argentina, but wherever Division 2 was, they were relegated, and then Division 3 relegated, and that kind of set the wheels in motion that, you know, they kind of shockingly reached, you know, finished second in the Division 3 in Argentina, and then after that it's been all downhill. They've been relegated in 4 or 5 straight tournaments, and doesn't show any signs of going back in the opposite direction anytime soon, or at least stabilizing. And a large reason why, again, is the player pool. It's just they don't have a vast player pool to pick from if you compare it to even the USA. I mean, the USA has got 16,000 registered players. Canada's up around, I want to say, 8,000 or 9,000 registered players. And if you're trying to have a player pool, a national player pool of 400 or 500 versus a player pool of 16,000, obviously the elite players available are going to be a lot fewer. So that's their biggest challenge.
Well, thanks for that, Peter. It's been great having a chat. And I think WCL 3, which is you've got America's Division 1 is in March, I think. I know you wrote about this like 2 days ago.
March 17th or 18th, that'll start up, and then World Cricket League Division 3 begins April 20th, and they'll go through May 5th in Bermuda. And so going to have USA, Bermuda, Italy,
Oman,
Uganda, and is that all six?
No, there's one more, I'm sure. Who have we got winning number two?
Nepal, Italy, Bermuda, Uganda, Oman, and USA. That's six.
Yeah.
So, as far as, you know, my opinion the whole time has been it's going to be come down to the USA, Italy, and Nepal. Just don't think the other teams are going to be strong enough to compete with those other three teams. And one of the big factors is the grounds in Bermuda are fairly small, and you get a lot of high-scoring matches. And I know back in 2010 when they had the America's Division I tournament there, Aditya Tyagarajan for the USA who scored 159, and I think he came in like the 20th over. And he came in the 20th over and got out with like two or three overs to go, and he finished with 159. And USA had finished with 360-odd or something like that. I mean, you can score very quickly in those grounds because they are that small. And I think there's in the 2020 fixtures they played in one match, Argentina and the U.S., they almost ran out of balls. Because, or I think they even did run out of balls, and they might have had to go find some extra balls elsewhere because they hit somebody on Argentina hit too many sixes into the bay or into the Atlantic Ocean. That's just outside one of the grounds there. So it could be an interesting tournament in terms of the number of runs that get scored.
Well, I mean we, and I say we because normally I hope to have a co-host. Would love to chat to you either in the lead-up or after or both if you're interested.
But, absolutely.
Thanks for joining us today, and good luck with those Division I tournament in the interim.
Thanks for having me on, Russ.
In other tournament news, while I've been compiling this podcast, the Asian Cricket Council has been conducting its Women's Championship for Associated Nations in Thailand. The winner of that will progress to the World 2020 qualifiers. And starting the 3rd of February, the East Asia Pacific teams will line up in Auckland to go through to the qualifiers for the World 2020 in 2014. I hope to have guests to talk about both in coming weeks. Thanks for listening.